of all the things that were taken from enslaved people, food was one of the things that we can still kind of point a direct link back to West Africa, the way something is seasoned, the way something is prepared. And so there are so few direct links, I think, back to the African continent. So those kind of fruit traditions are really precious.
Welcome to the History Drop, where we talk all things history. I'm your host, Brian Bullock. And today we have a wonderful guest, Deb Freeman, who is a writer, a podcaster, and now a documentary producer. And Deb, thank you for coming. I know it's hot here in Richmond, Virginia.
You got me coming out of the AC.
Out of the AC. But it's hopefully you've cooled off in here a little bit, though. So good. So welcome, 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 welcome. Let's start off. Just tell me a little bit about Deb Freeman. And I'm a fanboy. You know, I keep trying to tell you that. You think I'm joking, but I'm a huge fan. But tell me a little bit about you.
Yeah, well, first, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. So about me, a lot of people have kind of coined this term, I don't want to say for me, but have used it about me, which is culinary anthropologist, which I think is really interesting because I do like to talk about and write about the intersection between food, race, and culture. And largely when it comes to Black food, ways. I also write a lot about Southern foodways, but really kind of my bread and butter and what gets me going is where does Black history and food history intersect? So that's me in a nutshell. That kind of passion has taken form in many different ways. As you said, I've been writing for almost a decade about this subject, but also doing podcasts about it. And as you said, now I'm working on a documentary.
That's awesome. And we'll talk about that too, because that's a really great project. How that's such an interesting intersection. So how did you get there? Food, history, and then
So the very first article I wrote was about Black women who picked crab in Hampton, Virginia. And they picked crab and sent their children to Hampton, what is now Hampton University, what was Hampton Institute, but were able to buy houses, put their children through school by picking crab. And I was so fascinated. I saw a photograph of this and I was like, who are these women? What are they doing? And I wrote my first article for Southern Grit magazine. And fortunately, they liked it. And gave me the green light. And it really was off to the races because I thought if I didn't know this and this was right in my backyard, I grew up in Norfolk, then what else do I not know? And it just really has become a rabbit hole that really I can't quite get out of.
Yeah, that's
So,
so interesting.
yeah.
I've learned a lot about that too, about the role of women, you know, post Civil War and emancipation and this business sense. You know, being able to do things. We did a story about the fried chicken ladies and just what they were able to do and what they were able to do for their family. So yes, that would get anybody interested in that subject matter. So you have this new project that talks about Edna Lewis. Tell me about well, just tell me about Edna Lewis and generally, and then we can expand on that.
Yeah, so Edna Lewis is such a fascinating person for me because I think she's just right kind of hidden. There are people who, if you're into food, you probably know her. But if not, you're like, who is this lady? Edna Lewis was born in Freetown, Virginia, which is just outside of Charlottesville. And Freetown was an emancipated community built and created by emancipated Black people. And it was a fascinating community of all these Black people who had their own school, who were growing their own food and really a sustainable kind of community. And so she learned how to cook from her mother and from her grandmother, and her aunt, and went off. She left during the Great Migration, first to DC, later to New York. And so where she gets a lot of or her notoriety, her first bit really was in New York. She was the executive chef at Shea Nicholson, and what she was written about in New York Times, particularly about her chocolate souffle. And that's where there was a buzz, if you will. Later, she was executive chef at Gage and Tollner, and she wrote a really seminal cookbook. And this is really what's important. She wrote The Taste of Country Cooking. This cookbook really changes the the way Americans see Southern food. There was a stereotype about Southern food that's all greasy. The greatest hits I heard someone describe it as, you know, fried chicken, mac and cheese, collard greens, that sort of thing, which are all delicious. Those are things we, these are things we're proud of. However, the culinary canon of the South is so much more diverse and so wider than just those things. And so her cookbook really introduced that to the rest of the nation.
So she worked in New York, from Freetown in Virginia to New York. How have you learned like how she got from here to New York?
Yeah, so she made a stopover in D.C. first. And what a lot of people don't know about Edna Lewis is she was a seamstress. That was that was what she was known for. She made dresses for Marilyn Monroe. She made dresses for really important people. But when she gets to New York, you know, she's doing domestic work initially before she takes part at Shay Nicholson. And what's really interesting is that she was so renowned as a domestic worker for her food. That's where she gets, you know, where the elite in New York are talking about her. That's where she gets her, you know, her gravitas, if you will, in that community. And so she was really just doing the work that many African-American women were doing. My grandmother was a seamstress. So doing that kind of work was just, that was what was done. And I don't want to say she fell into it, but she really was pulling on the skills that she learned in Freetown.
So she was not a, quote, trained chef. This is this, she just learned how to cook from her, like you said, from her mother, grandmother, and so forth. So when she's in New York, what is she cooking? Is she cooking, you mentioned the souffle, but is she cooking like the traditional Southern dishes or is she doing a little bit of everything?
So there's a little bit of a mix because her very first cookbook, the Edna Lewis cookbook, is nothing like what comes after, what comes later. She's creating these very fancy, for lack of a better word, kind of dishes for women who are throwing parties and get-togethers. And so she's a caterer who's making very elevated dishes. So you will see things like the souffle, for example, in that cookbook. So she's pulling from, and I have to say, like, trained as in, you know, culinary school trained. But I think people think that that is, in some ways, it is a higher caliber, but there is a worthiness to home cooking and that tradition being passed down from generation to generation that I think a lot of people don't talk about. And so I just kind of want to kind of make that point a little clear, you know, more direct, because I think that we shouldn't negate that. Because those women were teaching her how to, you know, create skills. And I think what's interesting, I'm going off on a tangent.
That's okay. we can go off on tangents here.
What I think is really interesting, you know, I keep going back to the souffle, which is a traditional kind of French dessert.
Yeah.
People don't, I think, not so much anymore, but when Jefferson was president, and so we're talking in the, you know, early 1800s, when he's at Monticello, James Hemings, who was an enslaved chef, who was the chef de cuisine for Jefferson, he comes back after being trained for 3 years in Paris. He introduces what we now call the half Virginian, half French style. So even though she is in an emancipated community, you know, with her mother, with her grandmother, they're using French techniques. That's a direct line back to James Hemings. So when she gets to New York, although these things are not something she was cooking every day, it was not hard for her to make that leap to create these things because the mother sauces, those sorts of things, there's such a similarity to what was going on in Freetown that it was not difficult for her to kind of expand on that. That was a very long answer to your question.
No, that's great. The you mentioned the Virginia style of cooking. What is that?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting because it really depends on where you're from in Virginia, right? So, but we're talking about Edna Lewis, so we'll narrow it down to that area. So again, so you have, you mentioned the Ware Carriers in Gordonsville, for example. So what's interesting about that area and the food that they're cooking there, it's so influenced by French cooking because, you know, when these women were enslaved, if you knew what you were doing, if these mistresses of the house want to present, they were presenting French style food. So they are creating very light sauces, very delicate sauces, great, which we call gravy, you know? And so these kind of biscuits and gravy combination, those sorts of things, they're pulling from that French tradition, okay. Right? So it does, again, you will find fried chicken, absolutely, but you're going to find it cooked differently. So for example, you would put ham, you're frying it in lard, but you're also putting a slice of country ham in the pan with the fried chicken. That completely changes the flavor profile than what we think of today. So just things like that are really unique and specific to that region of Virginia.
Wow. So Edna Lewis really was the person to really highlight this form, this style of cooking.
Yeah, and not in a pushy way, you know? And so she's not saying, you know, this is a legacy that dates back to 18. That's not how she did that, you know? And I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, she really was the precursor to farm to table and seasonality. And so that's part of what makes her so interesting and so unique is that folks were not necessarily thinking about eating a strawberry at the peak of its existence, you know, because canned and frozen food was taking a hold of the country at the time. And so much like today, we can have a tomato in February. We can go to a grocery store and get it. Doesn't mean we should have a tomato in February, yes. But we can. But it's not as good as when it's ripe, when it's fresh off the vine, that sort of thing. So she's really changing the narrative by talking about seasonality. And really, as the forerunner of farm to table, she's introducing ingredients that should be eaten at the peak of flavor.
So do we know, it's so interesting. Clearly, she was a masterful chef. Mm-hmm. But what about Edna, like, as a person? Like, what do we know about her?
Yeah, I mean, I think the very first thing that's really prominent is that she was fiercely proud of where she came from. There, at no point did she try to hide that she's from a small town in Virginia. And I think that's really something to be celebrated. I think a lot of us, you know, if you moved to New York, oh, you're a New Yorker. And she never took that on. Yeah. A lot of people reference her elegance and the way she dressed. I mean, obviously, she was a seamstress, so she was very interested in African studies, and so that's reflected in her attire. I've talked to her niece in particular, Nina. I've talked to her, and, you know, Nina really described her as someone who was quiet, but was very much about her community, very much about family, and did not see her talent as kind of the way we're looking through it, the lens that we see it as. Yes. She was, you know, it seemed like she had a job to do and she just wanted to do that job to the best of her ability.
Yes, and so you mentioned the small town.
Yeah.
And in your second episode, you do talk about Freetown. Mm-hmm. Now tell me again, where was Freetown and a little bit more information about this place?
Yeah, so Freetown's about 20 minutes from Charlottesville. Okay. Unionville is what you would kind of call it today. Yeah. And so it was a smaller community. But again, these people, you know, cleared the land, built houses for themselves, and really were not completely self-sustaining, but almost completely self-sustaining. And they were a community that built a church. Edna's great-grandfather was one of the elders who created the church that still stands in Unionville today. And some of her family members still go there. So, you know, Freetown was a very close-knit community where you absolutely knew your neighbor. That's not unheard of, obviously, in that kind of time period when you talk about a small town. But it was a place that valued learning.
Yeah.
They brought in a teacher to teach kids how to read and write. That was incredibly important to folks in that community. So I think it's important to realize that. I think that the founders of that town and the folks that lived in that town really thought about education. They thought about sustainability. Everything I read from Edna, every time I talk to Nina or people who knew her, that town really seemed to be just a lovely, lovely place where folks could live together and figure out how to do that in a harmonious way.
And so I think I saw that there's a historical marker now.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Actually, in April, the historical marker was unveiled literally on Emma's birthday, which was really just a beautiful, beautiful sight. And so after all this time, now there is a marker that you can go and visit and see, which is overdue in a lot of ways, if you ask me. I mean, I remember going to that ceremony and one of the speakers was talking about how overwhelmingly white the historical markers are. And it's some incredibly low number, something like 8 or 9% actually are attributed to African Americans. And I think the department's working to try to increase that number from what I've been reading. But it's incredibly important, not just to that community, but to the food community, to the African American community.
So why, Deb, is African-American cuisine so important?
You know, I think that's such a interesting question because it can really be interpreted broadly. I mean, because obviously you're going to speak to culture and you know, a lasting legacy. I think for me, what I've come to kind of think about is out of all the things that were taken from enslaved people, food was one of the things that we can still kind of point a direct link back to West Africa.
Yes.
The way something is seasoned, the way something is prepared. And so there are so few direct links, I think, back to the African continent. So those kind of fruit traditions are really precious. They're really precious because it's so delicate. And the other reason, I think there's actually two reasons. That's the first. The second is, so much of African American food has been passed down from generation to generation. And so, you know, when you talk about your grandmother, she learned that from somewhere, probably her mom. And so you can see just from generation to generation, these recipes that kind of, you know, last the test of time. Yeah. And that's a really beautiful thing. But I think it's just important because the things that we can kind of directly point to that speak to who we were pre-enslavement, I think is really important.
How has traditional Black food crossed cultures? Because now we see it in all types of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
We see it all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so Black food, I mean, and this is not just unique to Black food ways, of course, but Black food really, you know, because it is delicious, because, you know, it has a very kind of comforting kind of association with it, there often is fusion, right? And so sometimes you will see, I'm thinking about Gage and Tullner in Brooklyn specifically. They have like a fried chicken and kimchi kind of dish, which I think is really beautiful, right? The chef there is Asian and she's bringing some of her culture to, you know, the legacy of this is where Edna Lewis cooked. So she's bringing Edna into it. And so it's a really lovely marriage of those things. I think that as wonderful as kind of cross-pollination is, I think that's also important to acknowledge where those things come from. Because if not, I think that we are losing. And I don't and I don't think people should eat just because it tastes good. I mean, yes, that is obviously an important factor, but it's not the only factor because that food came from somewhere. That dish came from somewhere. Someone had to think about it to create it. And I think it's really important to honor those people.
So Deb, why is the story Finding Edna Lewis, why is this such an important story to tell?
Well, you know, it's funny that that you asked that because I get asked that a lot and I've been thinking about that a lot because my answer changes. But really what I think it comes down to is more people need to know her story and understand that as not just a Black person, but as a woman to be an executive chef during that time really was practically unheard of in the 1960s. That, you know, at that point, that was largely male dominated. I think people think about Julia Child. She's a household name, right? But if you come down to the nuts and bolts of it, and this is no shade at all, but she was a home cook, right? So she was trained certainly in Paris, but she was a home cook. Edna Lewis was someone who was a professional chef, working in kitchens almost up until the day she died. And I think that that is something that needs to be talked about. Mm-hmm. She really was a trailblazer. You know, I've talked about how she changed the way folks thought about Southern food and really was a pioneer farm to table, which is a phrase that I think we all take for granted and everybody says, but that wasn't always true. That didn't always exist. And I think that she really led the charge on all of those fronts. And, you know, again, she's from Virginia. And so I think Virginia also gets a bad rap when it comes to food. People are like, there's nothing good in Virginia. Well, most of the food that you think of in the South starts in Virginia. And I think that you can start to see those seeds being planted through her work.
And today now you see chefs and, you know, it's all the Food Network. And was she kind of like that of her time, or would, or today would she be something like that?
I think today she would. Yeah. I mean, back then, I don't think chefs had that quite level of celebrity outside of like your Julia Child. Although there were people, you know, people who had television shows pre-Julia Child, but she, you know, I get it. And again, I'm not hanging on Julia Child. I own one of the cookbooks. Like, I am not hanging on that. But there is more than just that. There's more to the culinary canon in the 1960s than just Julia Child. And so I just think it's important that someone tells her story, and I'm grateful and honored to tell this woman's story.
And so she, you mentioned she passed. Where was she when she passed?
She was in South Carolina. So this would be in 2016.
Okay.
I'm sorry, in Georgia in 2016 when she passed. So, and that's another thing that I think is interesting, because this is not the far distant past. She didn't die in 1955. Yeah. You know, she died pretty recently. And so I don't think that she had the, although she was wildly acclaimed, I don't think it was the level of like household nameness, if that's a word, that I think she really deserved. And I would love to see that happen for her.
So you have this wonderful project right now, VPM, shout out to VPM, Finding Edna Lewis. Tell me about this incredible show.
Yeah, I'm really, really proud of this work. It's a bit different from my podcast, so it's a bit learning a different medium in a lot of ways. But Finding Edna Lewis really is exactly what the title says. It's my journey of really trying to discover who this often enigmatic person is, or was rather, and what her legacy is, what she meant to chefs, not only past, but present, and perhaps even future. And so we have been fortunate enough to talk to so many chefs who were generous with their time. We're actually about to film with Dr. Jessica Harris this weekend, and Mashama Bailey, and just all these really wonderful, it's all women, by the way, we're talking to all women, who can really speak to the influence that Edna has had on food at large, but more, you know, importantly in a lot of ways, what that influence is on them and how they kind of use that to push their own stories and their own craft forward.
What do you hope viewers get from watching Finding Edna Lewis?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that people obviously learn about her life and her legacy, which is so important. I want her to become a household name, you know? But I think more importantly, I want people to talk to their family members. And I really want them to, you know, think about why they're eating, what dish they're eating. All of these dishes have a story, you know? Why are we using paprika? Why are there potatoes in your collard greens? Whatever the case may be, I think you'll find an interesting story there. And in particular for African-Americans, a lot of us don't write our recipes down. And that's a living history and testimony to the generations that came before. And I think you might be surprised if you talk to someone older in your family. Right. I think you might be surprised and hear what you might find out.
Right. So you, in the second episode, I saw you working and preparing a dish.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite dish out of the Edna Lewis cookbook?
That's really hard. That is the hardest question you've asked me today.
All of them, right?
Yeah, but that's a cop-out answer. I probably would speak to her fried chicken, which I mentioned before, because it's such an unusual way, because we don't think about fried chicken being brined and then putting a slice of country ham in the pan along with lard. We don't think about preparing chicken in that way. And because it completely changes that flavor profile, you get this kind of salty meatiness from the ham. It's incredible. And so that was something that I could say, okay, this, I'm tasting history. I'm tasting something from 200 years ago that somebody did. So I think for me, that would be my favorite.
Okay. And finding Edna Lewis, where can we, what's the plan? Where can we catch it? And then ultimately, what can we expect?
Yeah. So episodes are going to drop every month on VPM's Culture YouTube page, and you can subscribe, so don't forget to do
Please
that. Please subscribe. And so each month we're talking to a different guest. Sometimes I'm cooking a different dish, depending on the chef. And then in February, there'll be an hour-long television broadcast, which will have some of the things that that folks have seen along the way, but really a deeper exploration of her life and more cohesive, because it's all there in that hour. So, so that's where people can watch it.
That's awesome. Listen, thank you again for coming by the History Drop. I really enjoyed learning more about Edna Lewis. And everybody, please tune in. It's such great work. It's beautifully filmed.
Thank you.
And I can't wait for the next episodes. And I can't wait for February. So thank you again for stopping by and talking with us.
Thanks so much.